Hello, and welcome back to Q&A, the podcast series dedicated to artists exhibiting in the Cadich and Morrissey Galleries at St. Ambrose University in Davenport, Iowa. My name is Christopher Reno, and usually I'm the one doing the interviewing, but this time I'm the artist exhibiting. So, for this special occasion, I have invited Brian Allen, the executive director of the German-American Heritage Center and Museum, to come to the gallery and discuss the work with me. It was fun, fast-paced, and there was strong student involvement in the Q&A. I would like to note that some of the voices in the back of the gallery were not picked up in the microphone. So without further ado, let's get into the conversation between Christopher Reno and Brian Allen concerning the exhibition titled Lucidity for the Home in the Cadich Gallery.
I want to go ahead and introduce everyone to Brian Allen. Let's give Brian a round of applause. Thank you. Thank you for coming and doing this today, Brian. And Brian is... he's an artist. I've known him for many years. He used to work at the Figge, and now he's over at the German American Heritage
Center
and Museum. And so he's kindly taken some time to come in today and have a discussion with all of us about the work in the show today. So I guess we will just we'll get started. Brian, thanks again, and whatever it's in your hands today.
Okay. All right. Well, I kind of tend to talk quiet, so throw your hands up in the back if you cannot hear. We don't have any amplification, so
boy, yeah,
it's going to ask really intimate questions very loudly.
We'll have to speak loudly, yeah.
But I think that can we maybe start with how you started making things?
Okay.
Like how old you were? What prompted you to maybe start to want to make anything? Objects, drawing. Coloring in your coloring book, whatever it was.
Yeah. I started drawing right away when I was very young. I know I used to spend days with my grandmother in elementary school. She would babysit me, so I remember drawing all over the tables and on the walls at her house. And cars, I like cars. I think my grandpa, when I was very young, taught me how to draw cars. So I spent a lot of time drawing cars all over their walls over there. And then as I got older, I found some friends who liked comic books or introduced even me to comic books. Yeah. And I think my parents bought me some G.I. Joe and Transformers comics and started drawing characters out of there with some of my friends in grade school, fourth, fifth grade. And that carried on even when they like gave it up and thought it was stupid and weird. I kept going with it. And so high school, a lot of comic book illustration at the time, back when it was super not cool. I don't know if it's cool now, but it was super not cool then. And so Spider-Man, the Hulk, Wolverine, Venom, all that stuff, yeah.
Neat.
That was my introduction to visual language.
Okay. Yeah, so drawing really early.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not even on the right surface, things like walls.
Wall installation, early installation work, yeah.
A pioneer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you see those things coming back now? Like when you look around, does it come through?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the painting in the back for sure is harkens back to the kind of way that I would draw airplanes. I wanted to be Air Force pilot when I was a kid, so I would draw airplanes too, you know. Uh-huh. And the little painting on the left is from when I was in my 20s living in New York. And so I was making work even then that was kind of talking about when I was a kid. I was making very narrative work with characters. And so that one is up because it's shortest. It sort of shows the connections over the years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's interesting to think about it, not only as something like how you learn throughout your life, but also you're interested in it and touching back to it and in your 20s, and now you're doing it again now. And I imagine that the drawing didn't quite look like that, that you're sort of incorporating it with for lack of a better word, style, but the way that you're flattening and using pattern. And
yeah, the pattern stuff is all new, but the shape is pretty much how I would have drawn it.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And the juvenilia from my 20s, the little blue painting, that is sort of in between also. Like some of the character work in there would have been very much tying into outsider art, but like Persian miniatures or miniature painting. And then also, but the plane shape there is also very childlike. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my early childhood development comes up a lot in the work as just a way to tap into the source, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think you and I were talking the other day, and I think I was really struck by the idea of game and play. Mm-hmm. Like if you set rules for yourself at the outset of making a painting, like I know there are some artists that will say, I'm only going to make whatever, two triangles and a dashed mm-hmm. line, and I'm going to see where that can take me over the entire surface of the picture plane.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting some of that looking at some of your work, because it seems like you start from one end, and when you get to the other, it might be a little bit different. It might have changed. There might be elements where there's a new color brought in.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like you're kind of setting yourself some parameters, but you're allowing your hand to move and to change that throughout. Would you say that's true in how you're making things?
Yeah. A lot of the way that I learned to paint in college, and after college I went to New York and was at a painting school. A lot of the ways that they taught us to paint involved seeing the piece as a total whenever you're making moves, making marks. So you make a mark here and you're affecting there, right? But it was sort of derogatory to say that you were painting like you were pulling down a window shade. Like that would be a bad thing to do,
right,
with that type of painting. Because, you know, if you're so lost in a little part here that you're not really seeing how you're affecting other parts, you could end up with some really wonky results. If you're painting a still life and, you know, you just trail off and you lose. That was the academic format, was to say, think of the whole rectangle and the way you're affecting it. And I sort of also think about the way that my mom worked, where if she's working on a quilt or some kind of stitch craft, she's not seeing the whole. She's working with a pattern, but she's seeing only the moment that she's at. And maybe you got to go back 10 lines and find a mistake or whatever, but
yeah,
you're working in the moment and you kind of see where it goes once you pull it all out and see it. And I kind of like playing between those two. Not that I reject the notions that I got before, but I think there's room for all these different ways of working. And for me, the idea of, like you said, start on one end and go to the other end. Maybe the triangles have gotten bigger or smaller or wonky or the wrong color. And then maybe I go back and rework and see. But getting into the moment of it, in the process of it, and then letting it go somewhere as opposed to really observing and editing in the beginning. Yeah, I definitely let that happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like to me that if you were to give this painting as like a project to someone.
Yeah.
I have a feeling most people would take a ruler and some tape and grid the whole thing out,
yeah,
and really line it up and make it as perfect as they could. And it doesn't seem like that's part of your consideration. It seems like the hand, the quality of your painting, the nuances of each like line that as it moves up between the other lines, and even the surface quality, they're like these, it's kind of chunky, like mm-hmm. there are these flakes in the paint
mm-hmm.
That I think a lot of people, if they're thinking about, say, geometric abstraction or trying to replicate a pattern, that they might be trying to do away with.
Yeah.
And you're kind of
right.
You're like embracing it, or maybe even celebrating it.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I find when I look at them. I get really excited by all of the little things that seem to be the changes, or the thing where I can tell that this is a handmade item. And it seems to be calling attention to that as being a handmade item. And then maybe like something else you said when you were talking about like the New York School is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Abex, you know, really heavy on mark making and mm-hmm. big paintings. And I would think that if you were going in there making things that look like fabric design, you'd be cast out, or, you know, you would.
Yeah.
You know, that decorative would be a bad word, would be a four letter word in a lot of painting circles. And now you're celebrating it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, some of this work still is pretty directly influenced by some of those artists, but in tangential ways, I think, ways that they may not even really appreciate.
Yeah.
Although I had one of my favorite painters, Rosemary Beck, who's some of her work has been at the Figge in the last 2 years. I saw some there kind of miraculously, but she's a great painter, great painting instructor, just a great artist and personality. But she, through much of her career, made these embroidered pieces, like lap embroidered versions of her paintings. Uh-huh. Like she was painting with thread and she never showed them. She always kept them hidden away. I think she put a lot, I think she put a lot more of her heart into those objects. And maybe she was doing them when she couldn't paint because logistically painting's a little more complicated. Yeah, her work now, that work now is very much celebrated at the gallery that shows her work, her estate. And then it's taken, that piece of her work is sort of taken off in the art world in a way that her paintings aren't seen, they aren't seen that way. Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, I think it's maybe it's like New York's Dirty Little Secret that it's provincial in its own way, and yeah. And there are ways in which to get past the surface level of what a New York type of painting would be. Yeah, but yeah, I don't think I would have worked this way back then. Uh-huh.
Right, Chris. Is there any paintings that you do that you sketch out first, or did the sketching or drawing play any role at all, or has it throughout the evolution of?
I see the watercolors as drawings for the paintings. Yeah, so working small with watercolor, I don't usually do any pencil work or anything graphic anymore.
Nothing underneath the paint.
Oh, on the nah, not some of them. Every one of these has a little slightly different story, but for the most part, I start with the unit of geometry and build out from that, and I don't really pre-draw anything or use any rulers for anything. It's just all. It's all the shapes themselves defining how they're going to grow and change.
You don't sketch out a composition for a painting first on a nothing. Does the composition come while you're working on the canvas?
Yeah, or sometimes I have some source work. Uh-huh. And some of these have quilting patterns as sources for sure. Yes, sir.
So with like this one, most of the time when you see paintings, they're like in the frame. So what pushed you to include the frame on?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, every framing choice in here is super different too, because I'm pretty inconsistent with that stuff. But for a while, I've been working on thrift store or hand-me-down art objects. I got this thing where I don't really want to add more crap to the world, so I'd rather just recycle old crap. And you know, then if I don't make a great painting, it's not the end of the world. It's carbon neutral, you know. So. And I'm not the only one to have ever painted on a frame. So sometimes it's just a matter of like, oh, I like how that looked, to let that thing expand past it. But there's something about this piece and a couple others where painting on the entire object just sort of became important. So yeah, that was a painting that was in my grandparents' living room for many years. And when they passed, I got all that stuff and just kept it around the studio as substrates to paint on. Yeah. Good question.
Should we be repeating their questions so you can pick it up on the podcast?
It's not a bad idea. Yeah, especially from the back. Yep. Okay. Yes.
So what's your perspective on mistakes as an artist? Like when you make mistakes when you're working on a piece?
Yeah, every mistake is a doorway. Every mistake's an opportunity. So, and in fact, on these, if there had been a plan, the mistake would be, oh, let's see what... Oh, I can't believe I messed that up. Well, wait a second. What does that do? You know, so there are a lot of spaces in here in these paintings where mistakes have led to new. I'm not sure that I can point any one of them out right now. But yes, if it all worked out from the beginning to end like a one-way street, it'd be pretty boring work in the end. Yeah. So you got to surprise yourself, too. Yeah.
So the question is,
yes,
were your mother's quilts inspirational to what you're doing? The person who asked the question recognized some paintings in the gallery that have direct pull from quilting.
Yeah, no particular quilt of my mom's is translated here, but the process that my mom employed of quilting or other stitch work at home after work. She worked at Gates. After work, she comes home. She sits and watches the Cubs game and does something and kicks me off the TV where I wanted to watch, again, G.I. Joe and Transformers. She kicks me off the TV because we only had one screen in the house, you know. And but there's a thing that she did for pleasure and for peace after a hard day's work. And that's sort of where I'm at in my life now with all the other stresses that are in my life, that process of working for a few hours a day is sort of where I'm at. So it kind of makes sense that I would think that way. And then, you know, a couple years ago, my mom took some quilt work that we had in the family, and they took them all, took the quilts apart and collaged all these quilts into these quilt collages that they, my mom and her sister, they gave out to different family members as sort of heirloom pieces because the quilts had fallen apart. And so in a lot of the houses in my family, we have these framed quilt collages, and they're crazy. They're crazy. I love them. So, yeah.
How did you come up with the names for your artwork?
Question is, how you come up with the titles for your artwork?
It's everyone's different, but usually they kind of gurgle up during the process.
Maybe it'd be an interesting time to mention this one over here, the Straight Up Thievery, and the title with that, and maybe how you think about appropriation.
Yeah. Man, thank you.
Because we have mostly a student audience. I'm
thank
sure
you,
they'd
Brian.
Be interested in hearing
thank you, Brian. I appreciate that question. Yeah, I found this picture of a crib quilt in a magazine. I collect a lot of old thrift store quilting books and magazines. I hoover them up from the different bookstores and thrift stores around the area. And this was just a picture, a very similar image was in one of the magazines. And I basically copied it. And that's why I felt guilty, and I said it straight up deeper. I mean, it was from like the 70s. It didn't have an attribution to it, but I really wanted to learn a little bit more. I wanted to more consciously learn about some of these patterns. And so I started painting from that image. It's not exactly the same getting translated into paint, but it's close. And so, yeah, the question is that right or wrong? I mean, you learn, the art world is weird with appropriation and copyright and all that. We all know copyright's a big issue. There's a long history of painters studying other painters' work, making copies of that work. I kind of consider this to be in that realm. If I had a way to attribute it to the woman who made that quilt, you know, decades or even a century ago, I would, but I don't. So maybe there's just one key to it with the title there. But yeah, that is a bigger question that I've been working with is, you know, appropriating quote unquote women's work in the paintings is an issue that I am still, you know, working with. Yeah.
Which has a whole host of other questions, but we've got one here.
Which piece would you say was the most difficult out of your career? Like, which one gave the most issues per se?
That's a good question.
Which piece created the most difficulty for you?
Yeah. They're all about the same. I don't lose a lot of sleep over them, except at the end. The end is hard. Trying to figure out when they're finished, when it's open-ended, is a hard thing for me. So I don't often know when to finish it. That's maybe where the headaches are, but they're all about the same that way.
The topic of inspiration, I was looking at this one on Let's Keep in Touch. My question is what inspired you? That creation, because to me it looks like woods, kind of with like a sunset background with the geometry that is your like touch.
That's great. Yeah, that's a cool read. I'm glad to hear that. I go to Michigan in the summers and spend a month up in a cabin in the woods that looks out on the water. I mean, through the trees. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what it is.
That's how I kind of saw it.
Now, what's odd about it is that pattern I ended up picking up from the chairs that are on the porch in that cabin. So the way those chairs are woven together, I sort of picked up on that, the way that they connected and played with it. And that sort of happened just in the moment. You know, I wouldn't be able to do it again. I don't even remember how I painted this exactly. It was very time central to that space. So. But yeah, good. I'm going to let you choose people because you're the moderator.
Oh, I didn't know there was more than one. Yeah. A question right up front here.
When you go into a painting, like a new one, do you typically like to go in with like a color palette in mind, or do you just like to see what happens?
Yeah, that's one of the things. It's usually the particular geometric shape, and it's usually a color palette to start. And it doesn't always stay that way. You know, the one behind... Oh, above Kelly's head there, the one on the right there. Was it not in my face? Yeah. That one started out very bright and yellow and orange, and now it's what it is now. So it changed over time, but I started with the palette.
Yep. Kind of branching off of that, do you ever start with a piece and are just not happy with it at all, completely cover it up and do something else?
Well, like that one, that's very different. I mean, it did start with triangles, but they were different size triangles. But that's the nice thing about this. That's the nice thing about oil painting. It can just keep working the thing to death. So it's very rare that I throw anything away. Watercolors sometimes, it's gotten like too wet and floppy and weird. Maybe, but most of the time, like, you can just keep working it forever. So it gets back to the question of mistakes and opportunities. You got to be open to where it's going to go, you know.
Question is if one of these pieces has more meaning, more personal meaning, if you have one that's your favorite.
I don't know if I don't choose favorites for my babies.
You put that one front and center.
Well, that one's fun. Yeah, that one is fun. It's newer too, you know. The new ones are always like the ones you're excited about or nervous about, right? But that one's newer.
You want to take we'll take one more question.
What's your biggest motivator, or I guess who even you mentioned your quilts from mm-hmm. or your mother's quilts, and I see a lot of kind of that design mm-hmm. here. So what's your biggest motivator for these?
Well, I tell you, besides that, these days I'm most interested in like Bauhaus art theory. So I don't know if you know anything about the Bauhaus, but that's a school of thought that started in Germany 100 years ago. And it became a very important, if you think about IKEA, that's Bauhaus. Like, it's a form of design, modern design. That school of thought has been up and down in terms of how it's received in the world. Some people like it, some people don't. Some people like IKEA, some people don't, right? Not to reduce the Bauhaus to IKEA, but but the modernist idea, the modern thought that came out of the Bauhaus is something that I really connect to because I teach it a lot. And because I teach it so much, it keeps kind of welling up in the work. So, you know, the geometry in here very much ties into the Bauhaus. That was a school, an art school in Germany that taught modern art. It's trying to break from the past and teach modern art. Now, that was modern art in 1930, so it's different. But yeah, that's one of the more, of this body of work, I'd say that's one of the bigger influences on it, if you're going to think about art.
I was just thinking that with our mostly student audience, if you want to talk a little about your career trajectory, how you got to where you are today,
yeah,
maybe where you went to school, and then maybe more importantly, some of those things you did after you got out of school and maybe before you went back.
Yeah. Okay. So high school in Galesburg, Illinois, about an hour from here. College, went to Knox College, also in Galesburg, Illinois. But I didn't leave Galesburg, born and raised in Galesburg, didn't leave there until I was 21. And then I moved to New York City, like straight out of Galesburg, went to New York City and stayed there for 6 years and just worked as a waiter, bartender, attended a school part-time, and just went to the museums and just absorbed as much art as I could over those years. And then I ended up in Austin, Texas after that, working at an art museum for about 5 years. And then I ended up in Iowa City for grad school. I went back to grad school 10 years later. So much, much later as an adult, I decided to go back to grad school and got a MFA from Iowa, at which point I kicked around the Midwest for a couple years and then ended up working here. So I've been here for a decade now. Yeah. That's the trajectory.
Question in the back?
So at what point in your career were you introduced to just colors and color theory, and how do you think that influenced your body of work?
Yes. So
the question is, at what point in your career were you introduced to Joseph Albers, the interaction of color, color theory, and how did that start to enter your work?
Yeah. So again, Albers is Bauhaus, right? And then he was also, I mean, every artist of the Bauhaus ended up in America or elsewhere because of World War II and the Nazis. Nazis closed down the Bauhaus. Oh my God. So actually, that guy right there, he did it. He's the one that introduced me to Albers in the Bauhaus. He would bring in Pantone samples. This is Tony Gantz, professor emeritus at Knox College. He brought in color samples, Pantone color samples, which if you try to buy those, very expensive, if you've ever tried to buy those samples. But he would bring in boxes of those and pull those out and have us make collages with them. And that was sort of the first time that I realized that I was just god-awful colorist and had no sense of color at all and made some of the worst choices ever. But that's what you got to do to get even a little bit better. So, yeah, I was in college. It was in college. Yes, sir. I'm slowly learning. It's a lot of trial and error. I mean, all through college, all through painting school in New York. I mean, I don't know. It's just, I'm pretty hard-headed, and I just keep grinding away at these things. And sometimes it's just me hoping to get some color relationship in these things that makes sense. And a lot of times that's where it goes. But I feel like I'm starting to get a little bit more of a handle on color that way, in ways that I hadn't before. So,
yeah.
So like how writers write, they have some sort of like ritualistic factor in terms of like getting ready, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is what like a certain environment or like music you listen to or this pattern that you see yourself get into before you start a new piece?
Good question.
Do you have any kind of ritual in your artistic practice before you get going on mm-hmm. an artwork that helps you kind of get in the mindset to mm-hmm. get going?
Well, it's not like super culty or anything, but yeah, there's a ritual. I mean, there's a ritual. I sit down in a particular space. Sometimes I light some incense. That's not even a joke. I really do light some incense. Make some tea. Get into the space. I work on the floor when I paint. When I watercolor, I work on the floor at a lower table. I sit on the floor to do it. It really helps me get centered for that. Painting, I don't. Painting, I paint at an easel or flat on a table sometimes. But yeah, there's a sense of getting centered, meditative quality to it. And sometimes I just need to jump into it to get to that meditative space, but it's helpful if I hit the ground focused for sure.
That was one question I had earlier when you were talking about your mark making and how it was calming, and now you're introducing incense and tea to the mix. do you think about this as a meditative act, as something that is mindful, as being in a sort of zone that puts you focused on that activity alone?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's definitely, and when it's working, everything else sort of falls away for a while. Yeah, and it might be 2 hours, it might be 4 hours, it might be 30 minutes, but if you can get into that moment of flow where you're just in that zone, it's really good. It's really good. And it's so much better for my well-being in the rest of the world when these things are going well, you know, and when they're not going well, I'm a mess. So, but generally speaking, this process helps me do it well. The way I used to work, where it was more image and narrative, a lot more anxiety. This work is more about finding a meditative flow. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Hey.
Two questions. Do you ever start with an underpainting? And I was looking at the pieces towards the back with the dots.
Yeah.
And they vibrate.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the op artists a bit.
Yeah.
Is that an influence at all?
Sure. Go ahead.
So what was the first question? Oh, the first question was, do you ever do an underpainting as you're preparing your paintings? Second question is, especially the paintings in the back of the gallery, are you influenced by any of the op artists? Someone from the audience, I can notice some retinal vibration in the pieces.
Do you remember that main op art artist? What's her name?
Bridget Riley,
yeah. I love Bridget Riley. There was a great show of her drawings at Art Institute a year or two ago. Really cool background on some of the more finding things, stuff that is newer that I hadn't seen before, but some also prep drawings from when she was younger and getting famous. And I love that stuff. I think it's less op art in process and more in outcome. Like, I don't think I'm directly thinking op art. I'm more thinking meditation and ritual, and the op art seems to come from it sometimes. And maybe from color palette choices sometimes. But yeah, I see an overlap there. It's not a direct influence. And then the underpainting, sometimes underpaintings. I'm getting, using more underpaintings. The better I get with the color, the more I'm thinking layers and underpaintings. So. Oh yeah, 3 to 6 months for the paint oil paintings, and that's usually the only one I'm working on at the time, so that's why there aren't that many.
Yeah. So the question was how long it takes you. You said 3 to 6 months, depending on the piece.
3 to 6 months. Yeah. The watercolors might go faster. Some of these are only a couple days. Some of them are a couple weeks.
I have to admit, I've always thought of you as a little bit like an art masochist or something. Some of your older works, I mean, they're so laborious.
But yes.
I think as we're finding out, it's part of what makes it mean something to you is being able to spend that time in the making zone.
Yeah.
If it takes 6 months, then it takes 6 months.
Yeah. No, I mean, I could be working on these for years, honestly. I mean, I think the little dot one back there was probably a year. The oil painting one is probably a year. That's the only oil painting in my studio for a year. Wow. That gets pretty boring to look at that thing every day. But also,
just see dots everywhere.
Yeah, I was in dot land. But but that's not unusual for oil painters either. I mean, lots of oil painters have paintings kicking around for a while. Maybe they're working on multiples, or they just crust them up and they take years. It's not super unusual for an oil painter.
Yes.
Painting specifically, Barking at the Moon, I noticed the gold border around the inner image of the painting kind of has some more texture to it. How do you achieve that look?
When I was in college, I had a friend named Joran who just recycled all his paint. He'd paint for a day and then come back a week later and paint again. And the paint had been sitting on the palette all day or all week. And then he would just like, he add some more oil to it and squish it around and make it usable again and just start using it. And his paintings were awesome. So I stole that from Jordan. Maybe he'll listen to this podcast eventually. No, but it's totally a Jordan Lindholm thing. For those of you who know Jordan Lindholm, it's like one person and two people in the room. But that's the texture from old paint getting squished back in, and not seeing old crusty paint as a bad thing, but maybe as a, you know, some painters use sand, some painters use marble dust. People throw stuff into their paint all the time. Jackson Pollock used cigarettes. He threw cigarettes in there. Tools, screws, anything that's laying around. It's not a thing that I purposely tried to do. I think it just came out of this process for that one. Because some of these you see, they're nowhere near as chunky as that, but some of them are worse, so.
Well, it seems like, as you talk about it, and as you talk about the frames, that there's this part of you that wants to reclaim old things, mm-hmm. not let anything go to waste, not throw anything away. Are any of these paintings over the top of other paintings?
Yes. Most of the 16 by 20s in here were student works before. So this and Straight Up Thievery were student paintings before, and I recycled them. Yeah. That was a hand-me-down. Marie, this one was your canvas that you gave me from Hobby Lobby, I think. I don't remember if there was an image on there or if it was blank. I can't remember, but yeah. Some recycling of images. And I have on occasion used some of that imagery underneath. I think most of these are paved over, but I have used some of the imagery on pre-used paintings before, so.
Oh, in the back.
When you were talking about this one, how do you not get artist block? Or how do you stay on one thing? Do you stay on one time? How do you work on it for 6 months, 3 years?
Yeah.
I don't
the question is, how do you avoid artist block and continue the discipline of working on one artwork for such a long time?
I'm old. I mean, when you're 20, I couldn't do that. I mean, my life was just too fast. But I'm old, so it's fine. It's not really that hard now. It's like the process is the reward. I really could work on one probably for, it's just sitting down and doing the activity is so much of the reward for me now. And it's exciting to try something new, but it's also angst-inducing to try something new, and then to finish a thing is angst-inducing, whereas in the middle part where it's just the flow, it's actually the easiest. When you're in the middle just doing the dots, you know you gotta come in and do the dots, and it's, yes, there's some rigor there, there's some discipline there, but it's no more discipline than going to work every day or going to school every day. You get into that pattern, and it's seasonal and rhythmic, you know, so it's a good question though.
I have to ask this question, even though I both love and hate this question. But you put your paintings up on the wall, so I have to ask. What do you hope people get out of it when they are experiencing your artwork, when they're coming around and looking, just any of the people out here that maybe you don't know, or just an average person coming in to visit? What do you hope they take away from it, or what do you hope they find while they're looking?
That's a good question. I mean, most of this work is really abstract, and that's challenging for people who haven't looked at a lot of artwork or haven't looked at a lot of historical or museum or gallery-based artwork where it's, you feel like you gotta have a higher ed degree to go in and even understand what's happening. I get that, and it's sometimes we come in with the preconception that an abstract painting like this isn't as skillful as a painting with people in it or something that looks as like it were a photograph. I get that those are challenges, but then I also think about like the simple pleasure of looking at a quilt or a great piece of fabric, wearing something really fashionable that has really cool patterns on it. And I think it's this, for me, the space is somewhere in between. So I'm not asking anyone to stress out about this work. I'm asking them to come to it and just, you know, relax in front of it. Because that's what I do, you know, that's what I do.
I got a question in the back.
Were any of these pieces taken off the walls of your
home? Most of them were, yeah. It's the Reno Gallery, is just all my stuff's everywhere in there. Yeah. I think Rich, yeah.
Following up on your question about the individuality of the artist. To me, this room is very kinetic with your art. The art doesn't go. Mm-hmm. Except this piece, several people have mentioned the tapestry. Mm-hmm. You said that it vibrated for them. Maybe it's a matter of perspective where you're at. To me, it's a new piece. I just flowed in. It looks different.
That's interesting. You know, back to the Bauhaus, there's this idea of the triangle, square, circle. With Kandinsky, I don't know if you know Kandinsky, who's like, he's credited as the first artist to make it a fully abstract painting in Europe, okay? We're talking about European art history, modern art, he's the one that made the first fully abstract painting, as if that's a real thing. But in the art history books, you'll read about Kandinsky being the one that did it. And he had theories about triangles, squares, and circles, exuding different feeling. So triangles were more aggressive and dynamic. Squares were more peaceful and foundational, but circles were infinite and spiritual. So I think there's some truth to that. I don't want to apply universals to anyone, and I don't think there really are universals, but I think that it's telling that you would say that, because those are the circles, and those are the ones that with the dot structures they're pulling inward, they're pulling you inward. You know, so, and the triangles are choppy and aggressive. I think they are. I feel that way when I make them.
Yeah.
Was there any thought process to how you set up
this work in here.
This work, yeah.
Oh, I have to give a shout out to Kristen and her partner Anthony for that. I'm actually pretty bad at that. Even as a gallery director, I'm pretty bad at that. So I always work in dialogue with others. I have ideas, but they tend to be harebrained. And then other people, like Kristen, got to come in here and be like, yeah. So, yeah, Kristen, myself, and Anthony, we just sat in here with all the paintings and moved them around. Said, well, what about this and what about that and that connection, you know? So there's a lot of thought that was put into the flow in the room. And there are relationships between pieces. And then there's dialogues across walls or through corners. So that's a good thing to explore in the show. But it's not set up to any kind of, we didn't plan it out by a year or anything like that. It's just all bouncing off the work. Yeah. Good question. Yeah.
Another question here.
Going on to the dot artwork,
yeah.
Was it something that you experimented with? And is the reason why it took so long because dots took so long to dry?
Yeah. There's a lot of those dot paintings. And that's the biggest and most involved one, but there are a number of them with different sizes, and a lot of dot ones that are about this big, but that a couple of oil paintings that are bigger, and there's a lot of exploration there with that, just in terms of, I don't remember all of the exploration, but there's a lot of exploration in terms of color and shape and underlying colors and all sorts of stuff there. Yeah.
Question up front.
What is a piece of advice you would give to an artist?
Oh, I would see as much art as you can. I mean, look, I grew up in Galesburg, Illinois, and it's not really considered a viable career choice in Galesburg to be a painter. I'm not saying there's a lot of great art that's happening in Galesburg, but growing up there, the culture is not one to suggest that you do it. But through education, and through travel, and then having an open mind, I learned a lot about things that I never thought I would learn about with art. I mean, that's the great value of it, is that it makes you uncomfortable a little bit, and that's good. You know, great art, you come into a room with great art in it, and you're not quite sure what to make of it at first. That's usually a good sign. You come into a room, and it's like, oh yeah, I know this stuff. It's like a great movie or a great song. Like the first time you hear it, you're a little bit like, I don't know if I like that. But you gotta have an open mind for that, and you have to see as much of it as you can, just like any other discipline. Yeah. And then if there's any other advice, it's to have friends, have a community, work in a community. Because I would never have gone to New York alone. I didn't. I went there with friends together. We moved out there together, and we had friends out there that helped as a support system, and we built the community out from there. And then, you know, as I got older and more mature, I went in different directions. But I'm lucky enough in a school to have a community. You guys are all the community here too, so it keeps the ideas flowing, but it's really hard to do it in isolation.
I think you meant, oh, yeah, one more.
Are you drawn more towards a piece of artwork than you are some of the others?
In here?
Yeah.
Mm. Different times. I'm back to squares now. Like the last couple quilt-centric things have been a really good experiment, but now I'm back to just making squares again. I don't know, there's not even really direct. I have other square paintings that are in the show that just a grid of squares, simple, like back to the foundations, back to basics for that right now after having put the show up. And so right now I'm in a square mode, but next time I don't know. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I got a little watercolor at home, at my table. Little rectangles. Yep. Little rectangles. Just nice and peaceful and easy. I'm gonna get out of here. I'm gonna go home and work on it tonight.
That's great. I was thinking about that earlier when someone had mentioned the length of time it takes you on an oil painting, that maybe do the watercolors help kind of, you can pound out ideas a little faster and in between
and travel with them too.
Studies or?
Yeah, they're studies. They're definitely studies and they're travelable. I'm always on the road and they, you know, there's not, it's just watercolors, very simple to pack it up. and work small and faster. Yeah, some of them do take a while, but they're definitely faster than the oil paintings.
You don't have any on your passenger seat on your way home, do you?
Not that bad. My friend Doug was making drawings. He's putting them up in the dashboard. I can't remember how he was doing that. I think he was just letting the sun fade them in particular ways. He was calling them his driving drawings. And he did something with his GPS too, where he was having the GPS routes be turned into drawings somehow. But no, I'm not. No.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about watercolor and oil. Have you ever experimented with other media, or how did you come to decide that those are like the two main sources?
Well, oil painting is the only medium for an artist. That's all I'll say. It's the only one that's any good.
Maybe you should talk about your printmaking background.
Yeah. All right. And some printmaking. Yeah. I've tried a lot of different stuff. I haven't seriously done anything except oil painting, watercolor, and printmaking for the last 20 years. That's really been my focus. But yeah, I certainly tried a lot of other stuff. Yeah.
Chris, is the dot painting made on like a found wood?
Yeah, that's just on a chunk of masonite that I had around the house when I'd been working on stuff. Yeah, it's on the back side of it, so it's on the rough side too. Like that.
And I'm just wondering if you think about this, or how much you might think about this, is if it's more about a pictorial thing for you, or is it a tactile thing? Because you're finding things that already have a different surface, reacting to that with the materiality of the paint. So are you painting an image, or is your emphasis on tactility, touch, and the kind of layering? And
that's a really great question. That's a really great, really hard question to answer. Except to say that I think most of this stuff doesn't represent well digitally. So like the website and the Instagram, I hate looking at it there.
I can't stand images of my own paintings.
Yeah, and most oil, I mean, some people make work that looks great there. A lot of people do. But that's getting at a core question of our existence, you know, in the world today. And so it's a longer conversation. I think I make these things so that they don't look good digitally. I think I'm making objects. And so there's an image there, but I'm making an object. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And it's very important to me that it is that, an object first and an image second. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, just most of these are flat edge brush flats. And some of them are carved back with a knife, with a box cutter. Just to scrape stuff away. That's about it. Yeah, nothing else really.
What qualities do you think it loses when it becomes digital? Because I think so many artists say that. You know, we heard from two here, but artists see their work projected or in a book or online, or it's just not in person. And we always say, oh, you got to go see it in person. You got to go see it in, and it's true. But these in particular that you're saying they lose something when you put it on your website, what are those qualities? Because, I mean, there are things that I see, but I'm curious what you would say is frustrating for you.
Like I said, that's a really hard question to answer succinctly, except that there's a lot of theory in the art world about that exact issue. And it starts, again, back in Germany in 1930. With like Walter Benjamin, or however you want to say his name in German, he wrote a really important essay called Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproducibility, and it is even more relevant today than it was then. Writing it just before he was hunted down and committed suicide before the Nazis killed him. You know, I mean, we live in a world of image overload. And the images that overload us are causing all sorts of slingshot and emotions and feelings all day long. Images hit us and cause an effect. And, you know, Walter Benjamin suggested that artists in the age of image needed to make different work, needed to make more political work, needed to be active in the world politically to combat the forces of like fascism, which ironically, we're making politics more aesthetic, right? If politicians were becoming more like theatrical, then artists need to become more political. That was the core of his essay at the time. And 100 years later, it's like same issues, yeah? I just think what he began that essay, though, by talking about aura. The objects before mechanical reproducibility, printmaking, had aura. They had a special, like, cult-like ritualistic aura to them. You could only see them in one place. They were often hidden away. And you had to have a relationship with them there, and you never saw them elsewhere. Like, that's, they were just there. That was it. And I'm nostalgic for that, honestly. I mean, whatever you think of the democratic quality of the printed image, I like the unique thing that can only be really absorbed through the full act of your senses. And that's sort of, like I said, I want to make the object. The object's got to have power. I feel like I'm, through the process of making it, it gets absorbed with, it gets empowered. So even if it's like my grandma's really crummy landscape over the couch, which I grew up with, it was a reproduced image, but it gained power because of my connection to it with my grandparents. Then it's like, how can I have these objects have that kind of power? Whereas on Instagram, it's not meant to have power. It's meant to just be seen and discarded. So, yeah.
So do you think you keep that in, like, is that when we're talking about the surface quality or the hand in the marks or the reason that each one looks like a unique thing or making it more object-like by including the frame around it? Are these some of the reasons for that? Or are you kind of, you know of that historically and you're making over here and they just kind of collide?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of both. Inherited and learned and, you know, taking ideas and oh, that's, and, you know, feeling it out. But yeah, I think so. I think it's all towards these objects having a unique and individual resonance, you know.
How long, okay, can we go to,
I think we should go. Yeah.
Do we need to see about any more questions out there? Burning questions? Yes.
This is terrible. I hate this. I've been doing this for 10 years, and it's, you know, for all of you who knew, it's weird that I'm doing this instead of being the other person, but I have to like tell artists in the future, it's like, I know what you're going through. I'm going to give you some prep questions so you're ready. In the past, I was just like, don't worry, just come. But now I'm like, I'm filled with anxiety for this thing. So.
Yeah. Other questions?
Yes, sir.
Just be curious about artists. You use the word talent several times. So, is it sexist to say that this is very masculine?
The question was about the word power being used, and yes, if it was sexist, if these paintings are considered masculine.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it is or it isn't, but I do, again, back to the idea of appropriating quote unquote women's work and the pitfalls there for, you know, someone like me to do that. I think there are real questions there and I acknowledge them, but I try to put them aside and just say, I'm trying to connect to my mom and just keep it that simple, you know, and then let the outcome be what it is. I don't think I could answer that question myself, but I think it refers to concerns that I have for some of this work for sure.
So many of the things that Chris has in his work, the women's traditional roles and a masculine approach to it, and the utilization of things to lower the impact of our carbon footprint, and just tradition really changed and expanded. So I encourage you all to take what Chris has shared with you and bring it with you when you go to the Figgy and check out that exhibit.
That's great. Yeah, I'm excited to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but yeah.
That might be a good note to end on. Also, I might encourage you to take these paintings out with you when you leave the gallery. Not physically, but mentally, right? Like when you see a neat pattern out there in the world on your clothes, on the fabric of a chair that's woven, maybe mm-hmm. you can think about Chris and engage in some of that kind of critical thinking of visual play, and maybe you can engage in some artwork yourself that mm-hmm. that does that. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right.
Whew. I'm glad that's done. Anyway, St. Ambrose hopes you've enjoyed this program. All rights reserved. Copyright 2024.